My name is Vinayak Shedekar. I'm presenting this on behalf of Rafiq Islam. He is moderating a session in another room, so he couldn't be here. This was work done, came out of the discussions in our lab, and one of our Fulbright scholars was the one who primarily did this work, is the second author, Botir Kaikov. So I'm going to attempt to present this in a way they intended to. So we're looking at two new methods for particulate organic carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur pools as early indicators of soil quality. We all know that the particulate organic matter is the fraction that's between the 2 millimeter and 53 micron, and the more the POM, that means you have carbon and nutrients that are being stored in intermediate pools. So there are methods available to quantify the POM, but there is a few attempts to actually quantify the carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur in the pools. So that's our attempt to quantify these four elements. We used soil samples from different experiments just to show the whole range of soil types and depths. Here, we're just presenting data based on all the samples together. Hopefully in our future publication there will be more detailed analysis of this. So we had some soils representing manure experiments, some of them long-term no-till, conventional till, and moldboard plow versus chisel plow, and crop rotation and tillage treatment. So altogether about 154 samples. So we collected these composite soil samples, processed them, extracted for POM. The fractionation was done just using the standard method recommended by Camberdela et al. So this is the standard method we use. Typically 20 grams of air dried less than 2 millimeter sample. Shake that for about 15 hours, in some cases 24 hours, in a 0.05% sodium hexametaphosphate solution, and then thoroughly wash that sample over a 53 micron sieve, and dry at 50 degrees Celsius, and then you got your POM, and then you use different quantification methods for carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So two new approaches we thought. One point of discussion here is the fact that the sodium hexametaphosphate solution is a high pH solution, and it's likely to leach some of the humic substances. So that might affect your carbon estimation. At the same time, the hexametaphosphate might have some residual effects on phosphorus determination as well. So we thought maybe let's try using the neutral 1 molar potassium chloride solution, and we decided to test a shorter time duration, 4 hour shaking versus 24 hour shaking. The rest of the procedure is pretty much the same. So coming to the results, here is the comparison of the standard method with the sodium hexametaphosphate for a POM estimation. And as you can see, both the methods based on the potassium chloride sort of underestimate that POM. But then if you notice the scatter or the standard error in case of sodium hexametaphosphate is a little bit higher compared to the other two. Moving on, if you plot these POM estimated by the potassium chloride versus the standard method on the x-axis, The darker circles, the black dots, are the 4-hour shaking time, and the white dots are the 24-hour shaking time with the potassium chloride. And you can see R-square value of 0.7 in both cases. So it kind of gives you an indication that, yeah, it is there is some good correlation between the two. However, as you saw earlier, there is some underestimation that's happening. Along with that, we also wanted to see whether the carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur we get from the sodium hexametaphosphate method, how do they correlate with each other? So we plotted the particulate organic carbon versus particulate organic nitrogen, and you can see carbon and nitrogen they correlate pretty well. That's very much expected. It is the results for phosphorus, and you can see R square value of 0.6. So again, the carbon and phosphorus ratio there is pretty predictable with a linear relationship. But when you look at sulfur, it's a sort of curvilinear regression that we get. Not a good amount of scatter there. So now we wanted to see how the particulate organic carbon by standard method correlates with the particulate organic carbon from the potassium chloride methods. So, and as you can see, R square values of 0.9 or more in these cases. Again, some underestimation if you look at the slope, but still there is a good correlation. One thing you can notice, that means you can possibly use that 4-hour shaking time to get a good feel about what your POM and the POC might look like. So moving on, the relationship between the nitrogen using the standard method and the KCO, again, very good R-square values, which suggests a very good correlation between the two. However, the phosphorus, we're seeing a lot of scatter, and that's where we are still trying to figure out what might be the reason. One possible explanation is the fact that there might be some more uncertainty with respect to just the phosphorus using the sodium hexametaphosphate. So we're still investigating that. And looking at sulfur, you can see the 4-hour shaking time doesn't really do a good job in terms of being able to predict the sulfur, but increasing the shaking time to 24 hours gives you somewhat better correlation between the two. In conclusion, sodium hexametaphosphate is good for simultaneous measurement of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So we could think on those lines. The 4-hour potassium chloride method can be a reliable and rapid predictor of POM, the organic carbon and nitrogen, and to some extent the phosphorus and sulfur. And then 24-hour shaking can actually give you a little more confidence in estimating the phosphorus and sulfur fractions in addition to the first few. I think that's pretty much I had. I wish Rafiq was here to explain this a little more in detail, but that's what I have. I'm sure I have a lot of time.
You do. You have 5 minutes. So if there's any questions.
Thank you. Here is his email address in case if you have questions that I cannot answer. Okay. Good.
No, there's one.
Do you guys think of using dry water as a maybe?
That's a good point. We did not use DI water, but that's a really good point. Maybe we'll think about it. Yes.
Do you see an
That would be part of when we look at the individual treatments. We haven't finished all that analysis yet, but that is the plan. And we're actually thinking that we might actually get different ratios depending upon these treatments for not just carbon nitrogen but also the phosphorus and sulfur. So that's just this morning we were discussing about it, and we decided to look at these ratios. So
all right.
Thank you.
We have a few minutes, so I didn't. Let's see. Are any of our previous speakers still here, except for me? Yes, there is. There is one. So I didn't know if you wanted to ask a question from any of the previous presentations. Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question regarding your comments on CO2 respiration. I've been working with these methods for a long time, and they were originally standardized, to my knowledge, in Germany in the 1950s by Hohenheim University. Even the method today in the ASA monogram by Anderson is from the original Hohenheim method. From the very beginning, we've always distinguished there are two ways to assess it: basal respiration that represents soil in a more undisturbed state, and CO2 flux represents soil as it reacts to sudden intrusion of water after a drying event. And both of these are very important states in soil that are increasing, varying particularly with climate change, when we have these drying and wetting cycles. So we're not just trying to exclusively focus on 24 hour, but it does give a really good indication of the response of soil to sudden wetting. And it seems like it would be better approach from your group to distinguish these two, basal respiration from short-term bursts, rather than trying to take one off the table altogether and go somewhere in between with 3 to 4 day respiration, which is coming off of the peak of a CO2 burst, you know? So it's not, we never considered that basal, but it's also not bursts. So to avoid confusion here, I think we should agree to distinguish these two.
Well, what we were looking at is short-term carbon mineralization.
Well, 7 days is short-term from that point of view.
Yeah, no. Yes, but we're talking about something to go through a soil test lab.
Which is why the 24-hour became popular.
It became popular, but what many of the test labs have found is that it's highly variable, that to the point where there's differences in the methodology outweighed the differences that you thought should be there in the field.
But that's been researched in previous ASA meetings. We presented the work we all did with the soil labs to distinguish issues with wetting, grinding.
I know.
Right?
I know.
But you're trying to take it off the table, so
yeah.
You need to eliminate it.
Well, we're not saying to eliminate it. We're just we discuss the limitations of both, and we can't recommend you do many of these. And there's a hope that at least one of them will give us an indication. But the issue with the 24-hour, no matter how you do it, whether it's with a sulfita paddle or with a base trap, there's just a lot of variability in that first 24 hours. And I, too, have been doing it for about 40 years. So I've done a lot of work on it as well. I come from a research environment. So, we are pushing to that 1 hour that's more stable, and when it's more stable, then perhaps we can include it in that suite. As I said, there's nothing in concrete, nothing to say you can't do more or offer, you know. This is just what we're mandating within NRCS. I'm not sure it's a mandate within NRCS. We can't mandate to anybody else, so these are just recommendations. Okay.